It's Radio 1's 50th birthday very, very soon, and we are going to talk to one of the legendary broadcasters from Radio 1 in just a moment.
David Hamilton on Radio 1.
It's David's Daily Dolly.
I like them fat, I like them tall.
David Hamilton.
Mystery star, clue.
Number one. The station of the nation, Radio 1, David Hamilton.
On Radio 1 every day, Monday through Friday,
David Hamilton.
Monday through Friday,
on Wonderful Radio 1,
Wonderful Radio 1.
Oh, yes. I hope that brought back some happy memories for you, David. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Fantastic to hear those great jingles again. I'd forgotten some of them.
I bet you had. There were so many of them, and they really evoke the era, don't they, that style of jingle?
Yes, they absolutely do. And what a fun time it was. I mean, everybody says 60s music was wonderful, but I think the 70s music was great as well.
I'm with you.
I remember on lovely summer days playing records like Summer Breeze by the Isley Brothers, and Summer the First Time by Bobby Goldsborough.
Yeah.
Just very happy memories of great times.
Absolutely. Tell us your particular route, David, into broadcasting. I mean, my own route started back in 76 when I basically heard a commercial radio station which had just launched, Radio Victory in Portsmouth. I wrote to them as a kid and said, I want to be a broadcaster. And they never got rid of me, basically, after that. What about you?
There were two things that I wanted to do when I was a boy. One thing was I wanted to be a professional footballer, and I had a trial at Wimbledon. I didn't get taken on. I was very keen on football, as I always have been. And the other thing was broadcasting. And my broadcasting hero I used to listen to on Radio Luxembourg was Pete Murray. And I saw a photograph of him one day in a magazine called Fab 208.
Yeah.
And he was horse riding in the Grand Duchy, looking very, very tall and handsome in the saddle. And I thought, what a glamorous job he's got, horse riding and answering his fan mail during the day and playing records at night.
Brilliant.
And I told some of my friends at school, I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a disc jockey. And they said to me, well, you with your South London accent, now you're going to be on the radio with your South London accent. So I got myself I hired a Grundig tape recorder. It was a huge thing with spools.
And with a magic eye. Did it have a magic eye level meter on it, David?
Yeah, I probably did. I lugged it home. It was a great heavy thing to carry. And I read things from newspapers into it, and I got rid of the rough edges of my voice. So anyway, how the break came along was that I'd got a job as a scriptwriter at ATV, and then I was called up for national service in the RAF. I was posted to Germany, and I was very near Cologne, which was the German end of Two-Way Family Favorites, which was the big record show of the day. It was said to be, Bill, the only radio show that it had its own smell, because when you heard the theme song, do you remember the theme song?
Da, da, yeah, da, 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 da. Absolutely.
When you heard that at Sunday lunchtime, you could smell the roast beef and Yorkshire pudding that was cooking. Everybody had the same lunch. Anyway, I went along to the studio, and I said to the manager there, I said, all this music you play, Bing Crosby and Peggy Lee, it's fine for the officers, but the troops want rock and roll. So he said, I don't think he knew what rock and roll was. So anyway, he said to me, I tell you what, I was 19. He said, I'll give you a program on Sunday afternoon and we'll see how it goes. So I was playing the music of Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and Elvis Presley, who was also in Germany at the same time doing his national service with the U.S. Army. And because the station director was so embarrassed about transmitting this heathen music, he followed it with a speech by the Padre. So the Padre came on afterwards and cleansed their sins for listening to this dreadful music.
Love it. Love it. And how then did you end up at wonderful Radio 1?
Well, when I got back to England, I went back to my scriptwriting job, and a job came up for a television announcer in Manchester. And I went up then, the days when announcers used to appear in Vision, the producer programs. So I actually started in television, although radio had been my first love, because I was part of the radio generation.
Yeah.
You know, when I grew up on a farm in Sussex, we didn't have television, we only had radio. So it took quite a while for me to get into radio, but in 1973, Radio 1 offered me a daily show, and along with Tony Blackburn, I was the first person to have a three-hour show. Tony, 3 hours in the morning, me 3 hours in the afternoon. The rest of the lineup was Noel Edmonds on breakfast and Johnny Walker at lunchtime. So it was a great team. And it was just before commercial radio launched. It was June 73, and commercial radio launched in October that year. So we were the team who were, you know, there to hold on to the BBC audience.
Wow. And what an audience. I mean, at its peak, Radio 1 must have got, what, over 20 million listeners. Oh, that's a colossal audience, isn't it, David?
It is. And in the mid-70s, there was an economy cut, which happens from time to time at the BBC. Not much nowadays, but in those days it did. And my program was simultaneously broadcast on Radio 1 and Radio 2. And Radio 2 then had a signal that went from Ireland, probably Dublin, across to Paris. So it had enormous signal. And we had, well, probably the biggest audience of the day. So, and then they asked me to do Top of the Pops. And it's funny, you know, all the articles recently about how much money people earn. Yeah. When I did Top of the Pops, I never earned £100. I think I got about £90. And we used to record it on a Wednesday night. And after the broadcast, I would do a disco in a pub in the Old Kent Road called the Dun Cow. And I got about £300. I was paid about £300 for playing to about 200 people. And I used to think to myself, how can this be? I've just done a national television program where I only get paid 90
That's
quid.
Great.
And then I do a disco in a pub in the Old Kent Road. But of course, in those days, BBC didn't pay a lot of money.
Mm.
So you had to, if you wanted to, you know, earn more money, you did it with doing the clubs.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the era was, for me, the golden age of broadcasting. People could say that it's a different era, but for me, it certainly was. I mean, commercial radio, as you mentioned, I was part of it then in the 70s. It was just a glorious time to be on the radio, as you say, the music you played, but the audience loved listening to the radio, and it was just something that can't be repeated, I think, David.
Well, you wouldn't ever get the same audiences again because, as I'm sure you know, I just brought out a book called The Golden Days of Radio 1. And on the front cover is a picture of the lineup in 1976, which I was very proud to be part of. And there's Ed Stewart, Dave Lee Travis, Emperor Roscoe, Alan Freeman, Annie Nightingale, John Peel, Johnny Walker, Terry Wogan, Tony Blackburn, and Noel Edmonds and me. I mean, you would never get a lineup like that again. And really, to put it in perspective, there are today 600 registered radio stations in the UK. At that particular time, there was only Radio 1. Television closed down at midnight. There was no breakfast TV. There were no music TV channels. So the disc jockeys were all household names. And for me to be part of that was just such a great thrill.
Absolutely. The music was important as well because, of course, Radio 1 could make or break an artist's career. And I often think back and say that was the golden days of music as well. And people say, oh, don't be stupid. You know, you're just looking at everything with rose-coloured glasses. But, you know, I've just played an England Dan and John Paul Cody record. Sounds as good as it did when I played it back then.
Oh, I was listening to that, and I thought that sounded great. And I thought, I must use that here. I was nicking ideas for you. I thought, oh, what a lovely record to be listening to. So lovely, relaxing at this time of the morning. I think, taking up what you were saying, part of the fun of being a Radio 1 DJ was breaking new acts and discovering people. John Peel in the evening, you know, discovered bands like Tyrannosaurus Rex and so on. And during the day, we discovered people as well. And in the 70s, when Sunday Night at the London Palladium came back, and it was actually live in those days on a Sunday night, I was doing the voiceover on the show, and I was sitting there watching rehearsals, and three black girls came out and sang a song called Year of Decision.
Mm.
And it was the time that Diana Ross was leaving the Supremes, and I saw these girls, and I thought they could be the new Supremes. Well, they were, in fact, the Three Degrees. So The next morning, I went to my producer and I said, what is our record of the week? I used to call it the Hamilton Hotshot.
Yes.
So he said what it was. I said, could we change it at the last minute? He said, why? So I said, well, did you see the Palladium show last night? And he said, no. I said, well, millions of people did, and there were three girls on there who sang a song called Year of Decision. And I said, I think that's going to be a very big hit. So he said, okay, well, let's change it. We'll go with that.
Oh.
Well, that got into the top 20. And the next record, the follow-up, was When Will I See You Again? So when we had, as it were, discovered an artist, we would stick with them. So we had that as a Hamilton hotshot. That went to number one in numerous countries. It was a multi-million seller. And when it sold the million, the record company, Philadelphia Records, said to me, would you present the girls with a gold disc on stage at one of their shows? I said, yeah, certainly.
Oh.
So I went along to the Victoria Apollo, and I waited for a cue from the MD, and I walked out holding this gold disc in my hand. The place erupted. I said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that When Will I See You Again has sold a million. Everybody was just up on their feet. I gave Sheila Ferguson, who, by the way, now lives in Mallorca,
yeah.
I gave her the gold disc, and the girls sang When Will I See You Again. I stood in the wings with goose pimples because I thought, I've been part of this story.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Sheila recently on the phone. She called me from Mallorca, and we did a radio interview. And later on, Prince Charles, of course, said, I love the 3 Degrees.
He did.
They're my favorite actor. And he famously danced with Sheila Ferguson. So they became by royal appointment, but I always say I found them first.
Oh, good for you, David. And just the mere fact that you trot out, you know, they sold a million copies. You can have a number one record now in the United Kingdom with 25,000 downloads. The landscape's changed somewhat, hasn't it?
Well, I've done a program called The Million Sellers, which
yeah.
has been out on lots of different stations around the world. And it was great fun putting that together. And very interesting doing the research on it. The biggest time for million sellers was probably the era that we're talking about, the 70s.
Yeah.
And there were lots of million sellers. But of course, I've been doing worldwide. If you just did UK million sellers, it wouldn't be a very long series. But worldwide million sellers includes, of course, the ones that have sold a million in America. And it's interesting, only two acts have sold over a billion records, and you would probably guess who they were.
I would go for the Beatles.
The Beatles won, and the other one, American.
Eagles?
Elvis Presley.
Oh, Elvis, of course,
yeah.
Yes.
The Eagles have had lots of big million-selling albums and featured a lot in the series, and... you play their music? I expect you do.
Oh, I do, absolutely. Yeah, fantastic. You mentioned Top of the Pops briefly there, and of course you weren't just rock star DJs, you were telly stars as well, and I always found it fascinating that radio people were thrust on the TV, whether they wanted to or not. Did you take kindly to the TV or not?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, I had done television before I did radio,
yeah.
So I learnt television on the regional stations in the 60s, and I worked for Tyne Tees Television, Anglia Television. So, you know, unlike today where people are just sort of projected into stardom overnight, you know, in my time there was a long time of learning the business. So I learnt how to read news reading, announcing, program hosting. So by the time the big national shows came along, I'd already got a lot of experience under my belt in television. But
yeah.
Radio was always my first love because, as you know, working at it, it's a one-to-one medium. And there is, it's an old phrase, but there is the magic of radio.
Yeah.
There's nothing quite like it. I've been doing a rock and roll tour with a band and singers. We started last year and we're into our second year now. And I love working to theatre audiences, and that's a different technique. But... If somebody said where I was most at home, it would be definitely in a radio studio.
Yeah, absolutely. And the studio itself, it's interesting you mentioned the studio. I was business partners and best friends for a long time with Mark Goodyear from who I met at Radio Clyde when I was there. And me and Mark started a radio production company. And Mark, of course, ended up on Radio 1. He used to be in the top 40, amongst other things. I spent many a happy hour in Egton House in the Radio 1 studios. And it just had a magic about the place. You just walked in and just thought, my goodness me, the legends and the programmes that have come out of this building, it's just magic.
Do you know, I had that feeling when I first went to Broadcasting House to do my first broadcast. Having, as a boy, listened to the Light programme, I walked in there and I could feel the ghosts of all the great broadcasters down the years, you know, within the portals of this place. And I thought, my God, having listened and been a fan for so long, now to be part of it was just so exciting. I'll tell you the other thing, Bill, which is interesting, is how studios have changed down the years. When I started at Forces Radio, BFM, which is now called BFBS in Germany in 1959, we were actually self-opping in those days, so that was way in advance of anything that happened at the BBC. And we had LPs and 45s, I think, was what we played then, on two decks. And then when I started at Radio 1, of course it was the same, and people would come to the studio, you'd have those jingles that you played would be on cartridges. And you had the two decks. And there was a lot for, if you ever had visitors, there was a lot for them to see. Then we moved on to the era of compact discs. And I always joke that I was the first compact disc jockey. we had CDs. And now you have computers. And if anybody comes to a radio studio, there's nothing to see at all. There's just a man sitting there with a mouse and a computer. So it isn't as exciting as it was, but it's, you know, it's progress, I suppose. It's how things change in time.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned there being the world's first compact broadcaster. Who gave you the nickname, David? I would find it quite offensive if somebody called me Diddy.
Well, I did a series with Ken Dodd in... You're probably not Diddy. I did a series with Ken Dodd in 1967 called Doddy's Music Box, and it was went out on ITV on a Saturday night. And the first time he called me, it was during rehearsals, and he said to me, in fairness to him, he took me to one side afterwards, and he said, "Do you mind me calling you that?" He said, "Because if you mind," he said, "I won't do it anymore." But he said, "If you don't mind, I think it'll stick." So I said to him, "I don't mind." And I've been stuck with it now for 50 years.
Oh, how fantastic. That's a wonderful story. I'm glad I asked. So the book is all about Radio 1, obviously. And the papers have picked up on the salacious stuff about this. And I'm glad we've kind of spent the most of this interview talking about the real radio side. But of course there was backbiting. Of course there were jealousies. There isn't any company, isn't there, David?
Well, we had a very big spread in the Mail on Sunday, which I guess is probably what you're talking about. And we had a very nice lady reporter or feature writer who came to the house, and we had a very pleasant day in the garden here. And when the article came out, it didn't totally represent the book because it seemed a little bit nasty. But I understand that, you know, with my son is a journalist, so I understand exactly that with writers they have to make it a little bit sensational or the paper won't use it.
Of course.
There were one or two quotes that were attributed to me that weren't actually mine. There was one quote that said, Steve Wright hated Simon Bates, Simon Bates hated Steve Wright, and they both hated DLT.
That's right.
Well, in the book, that is clearly attributed to Matthew Bannister, who was the controller at the time, and is not my quote. I wouldn't have said that myself. But obviously there were enmities between different DJs. People got very upset sometimes when somebody took over their program, as though perhaps they'd knife them in the back.
And
I don't think that was what really happened. The thing was that to get a program, somebody had to go, and you know, that's just the law of the jungle. You know, if it's like if somebody was hankering after your program and the bosses had said, I don't know, maybe you're the boss, but if somebody had said, oh, you know, I think we prefer to have him, then you know, you might get moved to another time slot, and that's happened to me, of course. And it's just one of those things, but not everybody can get on with everybody, and there are clashes. You're in a big ego business where, you know, you're dealing. I mean, bosses have always said, God, we're dealing with all these delicate egos. And you are, because, you know, fame makes people egotistical. It doesn't always make people nicer. Mm. Sometimes it has another effect, and people become rather grand or, you know, up their own backsides or however you like to describe it. Yeah, there were personality clashes, but there was also, which I think I capture in the book, there was also a lot of fun, and there were a lot of pranks, and there's one chapter in the book about Britain's first new DJ.
Dave Simons.
A man who did his entire program wearing nothing but his headphones.
That's right. I used to work with Dave Simons at Radio Victory.
you just said his name, yeah. He is a dear friend of mine, and he's now living in France, where he runs an internet radio station, and he's invited me over, and he's such a character. He said, we'll go out in the evening. He said, there's a nice tavern in the town that we'll go to. He said, we'll come, if we have a few drinks, we'll come back by boat.
Oh, lovely.
I'm looking forward to seeing him. But this time, I hope he'll keep his clothes on.
Absolutely. And what about you now, David? Where are you broadcasting these days?
Well, I work for a station called The Wireless, which is an internet station, but also on DAB in London. I have a daily program there. And then I do a lot of work for my local station, which is BBC Sussex and BBC Surrey. And I go in and do quite a lot of shows for them. And it's I live in Sussex now, so the studios are just down the road in Guildford. And also, as I mentioned to you, I've been doing this rock and roll tour, which is great, with a five-piece band, three singers. And this is really rock and roll, so it's late 50s, 60s music. And we've been playing theatres all over the UK. So we've done, I think we've done about 40 now, and we've got about another dozen to do this year, I think. So that's taken up a lot of time. And that's been good because it gets me out and about, and it's good to get on stage and work to live audiences. And then, of course, I was very busy working on the book, and that took me about a year to do, and it's only just come out. So it's come out really ahead of the 50th anniversary of Radio 1, which is in a couple of months' time.
Yeah. And I've got to ask you this, David. Are you still a disc jockey, or are you a broadcaster or a radio presenter these days?
Well, I suppose I'm a broadcaster, really. A broadcaster stroke disc jockey. I mean, my ambition always was to be a disc jockey, inspired by Pete Murray. But I sort of branched out into other kinds of broadcasting as well. So, yeah, I suppose on my passport it says broadcaster.
Good. I'm delighted to hear it. It doesn't say PC mouse driving DJ or something. No, absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant. It's been lovely to talk to you, Dave. We could talk all day. The book is called The Golden Days of Radio 1, Hot Shots, Big Shots and Pot Shots. Is there some kind of huge event that you'll all be attending for the actual birthday?
I hope so. Can I just mention quickly, by the way, if anybody wants to get the book, you can get it on Amazon, but the publishers are Ashwater Press, and if you go to ashwaterpress.co.uk, you can get, and they've set up a little system there, Bill, where you can get a signed copy. So if you want me to sign do a little message for you, you can either, if you don't want that, you can just get the book. But if you do want it, they've got a system there where I'll sign it and do a message as well.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I can do better than that because it's available on our own website, talkradioeurope.com, so people can go there and get it, but without the sign bit, obviously. So.
that's great news.
Brilliant. So, there'll be some kind of party. I guess there'll be sausage rolls and pineapples on sticks, won't there, at some point?
Well, I think there are two things that they're lining up. One is that they are going to get people back to be part of a broadcast that's going to go on. I don't know whether it's going to go on all day or whatever. And then that's on the 30th. And then the following day, there's a big party. And that's just where all the old Radio 1 DJs, you know, sadly, some of them are no longer with us. I mean, last year, I lost four dear colleagues.
Wow.
In January, I lost Terry Wogan and Ed Stewart. And then later in the year, we lost Dave Cash and Jimmy Young. So at the back of my book, I've got a Where Are They Now for the original lineup of 1967. And sadly, about half of them are no longer with us. So,
good Lord.
you know, that's. But last year was particularly bad,
yeah.
And we lost four of them. In fact, in our touring show, we do a little tribute to Ed Stewart, and the girls, we've got two lovely girl singers, and they sing Morning Town Ride, which you will remember was the theme of Junior Choice.
Yeah.
The first time they did it, when he died, I asked them if they could learn it, and they learned it in a few days. And the first time they did it, I stood in the wings with a lump in my throat because Ed and I were good pals. And, I remembered all the great times we had because we were at Radio 1 together, Radio 2 together. We played football together in a charity football match. We even rode together in a speedway race at Wembley Stadium.
Good Lord.
We'd done an awful lot together.
Aww.
And I saw a lot of him, and I missed him. Anyway, the girls did this lovely tribute, and we've kept it in because the audiences love it so much. And Ed's girlfriend has been along to two or three of the shows and really appreciated it, so it's good to have her in the audience.
How wonderful. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, sir. You're still sounding good, David. All the best, and I hope the book goes well for you.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.